You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is brought to you by the award-winning Institute of Culinary Education in the heart of New York City. ICE offers comprehensive career training programs in the culinary arts, baking and pastry arts, and culinary management in just 7 to 11 months. ICE also offers the largest program of hands-on recreational cooking, baking, and wine classes for all skill levels in your favorite global cuisines. Call 888-614-CHEF or visit iceculinary.com/heritage for more information. Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I am a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City. And hopefully you're listening to us live tonight, but remember you can always listen to any Heritage Radio Network program on our archive, or you can podcast them on iTunes. So I went to the School of Visual Arts for college right here in New York City. And I went there in the mid to late 80s. And back then, that era in SVA's history, the school had no official dorms. There were no dorms. They have a dorm building now. A few years ago, they built a dorm right on 23rd Street and made it so easy for those kids today, the offspring of the baby boomers who have it so easy, not like us. So anyway, if you went to SVA back then and you didn't want to just move into an apartment and live on your own at 18, and you wanted somewhat of a college campus-like experience, you moved into the housing that SVA provided, which was a room in Sloan House. Now, if you've lived in New York for more than, 15 to 20 years, you may remember passing Sloan House, or you may be blissfully ignorant, not aware that it ever existed. Sloan House was a Y. It was the Sloan House YMCA residence on 34th Street and 9th Avenue here in Manhattan. It was a big building, big 10 or 12 story building that looks like it was probably built pre-war 30s. 40s, and it was mostly filled up with the dregs and remains of the first half of the 20th century of humanity in New York City. By the 80s, it had really become a welfare hotel, and since the location of it was basically the greater Times Square area, it kind of held the spillover from the Times Square crowd, too. Now, if you're not an old timer in New York, I'm not talking about like the chorus from The Lion King. I'm talking about the old New York, the hookers, drug addicts, hustlers, midnight cowboy kind of New York, and all the kind of attendant scum and dregs of humanity that surrounded that crowd. They lived at Sloan House, along with a couple hundred art students. Now Sloan House has been converted into rentals, luxury rentals. I think that happened probably during the boom, maybe 10 years ago. That whole block is completely different. Absolutely different. Times really change. Anyway, so SVA leased out like two or three floors of Sloan House, I don't remember. And we each got a room. And those rooms were 6 feet by 10 feet. They were very small. And then you got another room that you shared with another student, and that was supposed to be our studio space because we were artists. And those rooms were so small that you could barely live in them. They were that small because they were never actually meant for people to live in. They were meant for like the occasional sailor or vagrant or traveler to flop in for an occasional night, not for a student to move in and live for two semesters. And it was really grim. It was dirty and smelly. I mean, the place was a dump. By the 80s, it was really falling apart. It reeked of despair and failure and cigarette smoke. It was a real kind of icon of New York to me, of the decline years of New York, the kind of mid to late 20th century. Before Giuliani and his big clean sweep, before the real estate boom made living on a place like 34th and 9th totally acceptable. It's like where Joe Buck from Midnight Cowboy would have lived if he hadn't gotten on the bus to Florida. If he had stayed in New York, he would have lived at Sloan House. So we would spend a lot of time sitting out in the hallway since our rooms were so small, or if we weren't at classes, hanging out in the hallway, it was pretty depressing. And I only lived there for one school year, two semesters, and then I decamped for the East Village, which back then wasn't much safer or nicer, but in my mind was infinitely cooler and the better choice. So anyway, I'm getting to my point. That first year at Sloan House, I was friends with a girl who was from Holland. She was Dutch, but she had kind of spent some time in the States, and she'd gone to boarding school in Michigan, and she had never really spent any time in New York before that first year at SVA. So she and another foreign student used to spend a lot of time exploring the city, and basically they would get on the subway, pick a subway line, and they would ride it to the end. Then they'd get around, they'd get out, they'd look around, then they'd get back on. So one day she came back, and I saw them, and I asked them where they had gone, and this Dutch girl, in her kind of big, blonde, naive, accented way, said, "We went to Rock Faraway." "Rock Faraway?" I asked her. "Yeah, we got on the A train, and we got off at the end in Rock Faraway." And I thought, and I said, "Oh, you mean Far Rockaway?" And she said, "Yeah, Far Rockaway." She said, "We got out. It was really scary. Everybody was black. It was very poor. So we got back on the train and we came back." I said, "Oh, Far Rockaway." So if you're not familiar with Far Rockaway, it's like the last little blip of New York City on this finger of land that kind of runs along the bottom of Brooklyn, Coney Island, and then out into Queens. Stretches all the way out to the end of the line, to right to the Nassau border. And right at the end is Far Rockaway. Now, Far Rockaway used to be a beach resort town early in the 20th century. And before that, it was a beach resort in the Victorian era. People from the city would go there in the summer, stay in these beautiful Victorian boarding houses, or they would rent bungalows. It was where you went for a summer holiday. Of course, later on, it fell into steep decline and is only now, I think, really starting to come back. But the funny thing about Far Rockaway was, in the middle of all of that decay and slow decline, was this little community of Orthodox Jews who kind of held on, like this little island in the middle of the fall of Rome or something. So they lived in this little community surrounded by these miserable housing projects that the city built when they came in and tore down all the beautiful old Victorians. They put up big, ugly housing projects. And then there was this little town there. And that was Far Rockaway. And that is my ancestral hometown. My grandparents and many family members lived there. I don't really know how it happened, how they wound up there, but at some point, some branch of my family split off and moved to Far Rockaway. And when I was born and my sister was born, that's where we lived until about a year after I was born and we got out of there. Like many refugees, we escaped religious persecution, basically, and hightailed it out for the greener pastures and lower taxes of Eastern rural Long Island, which I talked about last week. The Orthodox Jewish family side stayed on. We got out because we were not religious. My grandparents, my aunt, uncles, cousins, and then all these other relatives who I could never keep straight, who seemed to constantly be having children, they all stayed. And so every, I don't know what it was, every month, every couple weeks, I can't remember. As a kid, it seemed like almost every weekend, we would make the long drive back to Far Rockaway, because we had to go and visit and stay for the dreaded, awful, hair-pulling-out-with-boredom event known in my family as Shabbos. Now, you may know this word as Shabbat or the Sabbath, the weekend of restful prayer and synagogue services and sleeping and family time and sneaking cigarettes on the porch, if you're my grandfather, and, of course, eating. And we used to have to go and spend Shabbos with my grandparents. And if you're not familiar with the laws of Orthodox Jews, basically, you can't drive, you can't watch TV, you can't listen to the radio, you can't turn on anything electrical, you can't write, you can't cut paper, you can't cook. You can't do anything that's basically defined as work. So what do? Well, you go to shul, you go to temple services, you eat pre-cooked food or cold food. You read, you're allowed to read, you sleep. Or if you're a 6-year-old living a non-religious life, at all other times, of the week, you go out of your mind with boredom that drives you to the brink of insanity. That was me. I hated it. I hated all of it. Everything from having to sit through services to the tomb-like silence of everybody reading or sleeping afterwards to the TV just sitting there mocking me. I hated everything about it except, of course, that we basically ate all weekend. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what we ate on Shabbos. We'll be right back. Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's episode is brought to you by the award-winning Institute of Culinary Education in the heart of New York City. For more information, call 888-614-CHEF or visit iceculinary.com/heritage. Welcome back to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I am Erica Wides, your host. Remember that you can always listen to any of our shows archived on heritageradionetwork.com. You can also podcast any of our shows on iTunes, or you can listen live whenever the shows are on. Also, if you're a fan of Why We Cook, you can find me and Why We Cook on Facebook. Just search for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Let me know that you're a fan. Drop me a line. You can also make comments about the show there or on the Heritage Radio Network website. You can leave comments about the show. Okay. So anyway, what we're talking about this week, and there is a point. I'm getting to it. It's about food. It's coming. So I was talking about having to spend the Sabbath weekend as a child in Far Rockaway with my Orthodox relatives. And the only saving grace of the whole thing was the food. We got to eat, because what do Jews do? We eat. And so there was always a lot of food. But because these were observant people, they followed the laws of Sabbath, which meant that you could not cook from sunrise on Friday to sunset on Friday. Sunset. Yeah, when it goes down to sunset on Saturdays. 24 hours, no cooking. Now, I was 5, 6, 7 during these years of visiting. And since cooking was forbidden, my grandmother, who was not the greatest cook, would make a meal on Friday. She put all the hot food in the oven before sundown on Friday. We would eat our hot Friday night dinner, and then she would leave it in there in the oven. I guess on really low, but she'd leave it in there until sundown on Saturday, when it would become Saturday's dinner. Also, but the really big meal, the important meal, was lunch on Saturday after services, after shul. And because of that, and because she couldn't cook, it was usually a cold meal, and it was always a meat meal, because when you keep kosher, which they did, you had to decide if your meal was meat or dairy, because you couldn't mix them, and you had to separate your meat and your dairy meals by, I think, 5 hours or something. So usually it was meat, and usually it was deli, which was great. We would eat all kinds of sliced stuff because, as it turns out, my grandmother was a pretty bad cook, and the things that I really liked that she did serve were actually things that she had bought pre-cooked from Empire Kosher, from Walbaum's. So when she served deli, I think it made everybody pretty happy. And I would call her an early adapter of the convenience foods, because she bought an awful lot of stuff pre-made. So on Saturdays for lunch, we'd usually have this like cold spread of sliced deli meats like turkey and Hebrew National salami, cold roast beef, whatever. And of course, there was tongue, cold sliced tongue, which as a kid, I actually loved. It never really occurred to me that tongue was tongue. I just really liked it. It was good on sandwiches. But I'm not here today to talk about tongue, although that would be a good show. The thing I'm here to tell you about is the one thing that she served that made such an impression on me that it's now taken me almost half of my show to get to. The one food that I am basing this entire show on tonight was a bowl of peas. My grandmother served cold, canned peas. She opened up the can. She dumped it into her white and gold china bowl from the meat dishes. And she put that bowl of peas on the table as a vegetable to eat cold with our cold deli meats. Yes, listeners, cold canned peas. It's a miracle that I even like food today after suffering that abuse. Now, my grandma, Grandma Pauline, she was in most other ways a very loving, kind, generous lady. Wouldn't hurt a flea. Lots of grandchildren. Very wonderful person. Would open a can of peas and serve them to her grandchildren cold. Now, as I was thinking about this, I thought, okay, we eat other canned things cold. We eat cold beets, canned beets. We eat beans right out of the can in salads. Even corn from the can tossed into a black bean salad. We eat that stuff. Why not peas? Well, these weren't like good quality, tiny, fresh, petit pois, nice green peas. These were big, soggy, army khaki green peas in the can from Walbaum's. If you didn't grow up in New York, you might not be familiar with Walbaum's, but it was a pretty bad supermarket. And when you open that can of peas, there was a smell. And the smell was kind of farty and kind of sulfurous and kind of Sloan House smelling. It didn't smell like food. Now, back at home in our secular world, things were better, slightly better. I mean, it was the 70s. We were eating frozen vegetables. But frozen vegetables, I think, are a pretty good choice if that's all you have. The produce choices fresh at the market were not great back then. They were pretty bleak. And frozen was the way to go until summer. We had a big garden. In the summer, we had the garden and we had fresh peas. Now, I think a lot of people grow up thinking they don't like peas because they've never eaten really fresh peas. They've eaten them canned or they've eaten them frozen or they've eaten peas that they buy in the supermarket that are kind of old. And that's really a crying shame, as Lyle Lovett would say, because fresh young sweet peas are one of the true food miracles of spring. They are really sweet and really tender and really fresh, and they just taste like spring. They're like little green gems from a vine. And when I was a little kid, I would just go out into the garden and I would eat the peas right off the vine. I would pop open the pods, pull out the peas, and just chow down on them raw because they were so good and so sweet and so fresh. And because they're a legume, they're a little, you know, pod, they're very sweet when they're still attached to the plant. But as soon as you pick them, the sugars in them start to convert to starch, like varieties of sweet corn used to do before genetically engineered sweet corn that stays sweet after it's picked. Same thing. You had to pick the corn and cook it instantly or it would turn starchy. Same thing with the peas. And I think people think they don't like peas because they never had them that fresh. So we always grew shelling peas, English peas, the kind that are in the pod that you have to take out of the pod. But I personally think if you're going to grow peas or if you're going to buy peas, sugar snaps are the way to go. With a sugar snap pea, you don't have to do any work except trim off the little tough stem at the top. And you get to eat the pea and the pod. So you get double your value for your money. With English shelling peas, you only get the pea. You can't eat the pod because the pods are too tough to eat. So what's the point? Now, I'm a very value-minded kind of person. So I think, why not get something where you get two for one? You get the shell and the pea. We have to take another little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk some more about peas.
Trying to feign to camouflage his mind.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is brought to you by the Institute of Culinary Education. For more information, go to iceculinary.com/heritage. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And this week we're talking about peas. Good peas. Fresh peas right off the vine. Not cold canned peas from Walbaum's that my grandmother used to serve to me. And during the break, Jack came in, Jack's producer, and said that he is very familiar with the Walbaum's brand because as a child his mom worked for them and he had to spend some time there, and we were talking about the Walbaum's logo and how dated it was and how there was always this little picture of Julia Walbaum on the can and it always said Julia Walbaum recommends. Now Julia Walbaum I think is dead. I hope she's dead, because if she's still alive after eating that crappy food, then everything we know about nutrition today is wrong. But anyway, so we're talking about peas, and I was talking about how I think that sugar snap peas are the way to go because you get double your value for your money. Because with a sugar snap pea, you eat the pod and the pea, whereas an English shell pea, you only get to eat the peas. But it is kind of fun to sit and shuck peas up to a certain point. Now, when I cook sugar snap peas, what I like to do is just really quickly blanch them. Just drop them in boiling water. Make sure you put some salt in there. Sometimes people put a little sugar in there too. Just blanch them quick till they're green, bright green. Take them out, drop them in ice water and shock them. Then cut them in half. If you cut them before you blanch them, they'll be open and then all the little baby peas inside fall out into your blanching water and then you have to fish them out. I also think they stay crisper if you blanch them whole first. And then you can just toss them with a little olive oil or a little butter, a little salt. Throw in some chives, maybe a little bit of mint. You know, that's the classic combination of peas and mint is so good. And you're ready to go. Or you can make like a pasta dish like last night, for example. I had whole wheat fettuccine that I wanted to use up. So I cooked that. And I had some collard greens that I'm growing in my garden. And so I chiffonaded those, which means cut them into really, really fine ribbons. So as the pasta was cooking, I sauteed the collard greens with a lot of garlic, like 6 cloves of garlic. I blanched my sugar snaps. I found some old prosciutto in my fridge, so I slivered that up, and I sauteed that with the collards. And then I found a bag of walnuts that was basically just a pile of walnut dust, and so I threw the walnut dust in there. And I mixed it all together with a blob of ricotta that I got at the farmer's market. And it was pretty good, although this ricotta that I bought was non-fat ricotta, which it didn't say it on the package when I bought it, but then when I read the ingredients, it said it was made from skim. And it was kind of grainy and kind of weird and not very good. And I'm considering taking it back, although I think that's a little weird to return food to the farmer's market. Even though I return stuff to stores all the time, I love taking things back, even to supermarkets. But something about taking it back to the farmer sort of makes me feel get bad and guilty. I don't know. Anyway, back to this. So the sugar snaps added this really nice sweetness to the dish, along with the kind of like minerally flintiness of the collard greens and the saltiness of the prosciutto. And it was a pretty good dish, I must say. It came out pretty nice. I just threw it together, spur of the moment. It needs a little tweaking and fine tuning. If I were going to put it on a menu, I'd have to work on it a little bit. But it was great. And sugar snaps also, to me, are like the perfect balance. It's almost like two vegetables in one, because you get the kind of sweet, starchy, legume of the pea, and then you get the very like juicy, fleshy crunch of the pod. And the pod is just, you know, pure vegetable, zero sugar flesh, and the pea has all that sugar in it. So it kind of balances it out really nice. I mean, they're really just beans, those peas. But you get like two in one, and that's why I like them. I also prefer them over snow peas. You know, snow peas or the Chinese pea pods? I mean, those are good. You get the pod. But where's the pea? What's the point? If there's no pea, it's all pod. And as I said, I like value. So sugar snaps to me are the perfect balance. And they're also very delicate. And they can't really tolerate high heat. If you've ever tried to cook them for too long, they just fall apart. And that's why you'll never see them canned, in case you ever looked. If you are out there looking at canned vegetables, you'll never see canned sugar snap peas, only canned English peas. But you can get them frozen. I've seen them frozen. But right now they're in season and they're at the Green Market, so that's where you should be going. You should head to the market and you should get yourself some sugar snap peas. Or you can grow them. I have some growing in my little garden too, and they grow really well, and they're very easy to grow. And like all pea varieties, if you're growing them, you get a third added value product, which is that you can actually eat the plants themselves, the pea shoots. And you could just grow peas for the pea shoots, especially if you're impatient and don't want to wait. You could just eat the plant. The plants are great because they taste like peas, but they're leafy and kind of delicate. They almost have like almost like watercress kind of texture to them. A little bit stringy, kind of leafy. And you can cook them. Just give them a really, really quick wilting, a quick stir fry, or you can eat them raw. But you have to make sure if you're eating pea shoots that you're eating young pea shoots. So if you buy them, make sure they look young and tender. Because one time I grew a bunch of sugar snap peas, and after they stopped producing, I thought, oh, let's eat the plants. And it was kind of like trying to eat green fishnet stockings. You can't eat the plants once they're old. So don't do that. And, you know, peas are a spring vegetable. And they're one of the first, one of the earliest spring vegetables that we get, along with asparagus and ramps and fiddleheads and young spinach and all that. And so, you know, if you want to kind of try to live within the seasons, eating those first peas of the year is one of the great joys of food, of experiencing things in the cycle of nature. You know, I mean, you can buy them frozen all year round. You could eat them canned, like my grandmother. But eating those first peas early in the spring, I mean, that's like a miracle. And so yesterday when I saw them at the market, I splurged. I bought some. And they don't tolerate heat well, so they're really an early spring crop. So you should get out there and you should get some now, because in a few weeks there will be no more peas available for you. And if I catch you opening up a can of peas, you're going to have to go spend a month at Sloan House as punishment. So we're just about out of time tonight in the pea section of the show. But I just wanted to give you a little bee update. I haven't talked about my bees in a couple of weeks. And my bees are doing very well. I put the second deep super on top a few weeks ago, and they're slowly starting to build that out. And I think it'll be probably another 2 or 3 weeks. And then I'm going to put the honey super on, which is the shallow box that goes on top. And then we'll see what happens. If they start filling that up with honey, then it's good news for me, and I'll have honey by the end of the summer, hopefully. If not, we'll have to figure out what went wrong. Anyway, thanks for listening. Again, like I said, you can find us on Facebook at Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'd love for you to become a fan. Leave a comment. You can also leave comments on the Heritage Radio Network website. And I also have a blog. I have whywecook.com, which I seem to never mention. But you can go on there, too, and leave comments, questions, anything. I'd love to hear from you. So we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Nat and Jack in the control room. Have a good night.